folks. I'm David Goldstein.
And I am Brian Brinkman.
You are tuned in to episode 21 of the Beyond the Pond podcast. Our little podcast is all grown up and able to drink. This is the podcast was generally Brian and myself use the music of Phish to introduce the listener to other bands that they may not be aware of, generally not jam bands. Because we love Phish, we are Phish fans. But sometimes a problem is going to come about. You're going to start trying to download these Phish songs and these Phish albums, and it's going to go really, really, really slowly because of net neutrality may no longer exist. So you got to go download some other bands, and hopefully those bands are nicer to you and have higher download speeds. But the greedy telecom companies want to take your Phish away. So you really got to start branching out and hear some other acts and get that music.
Exactly. We are here to spread the word, go beyond the pond, and hopefully take up your time when you're waiting on slow internet. This is, like Dave said, our 21st episode, and today's a really special episode. This is our holiday run special. If you had told me a year ago that our podcast was going to go 21 episodes and that we were going to do a 1970s era Christmas special, I wouldn't have believed you, but I'm glad that we're here. This is fun. We're definitely indulging a little bit more relaxed tonight in the Christmas spirit. We are not going to be, I doubt we'll be participating in our drinking game. We'll just say the war on drugs right now to get it out of the way because we are 21 now.
Yes.
But we're going to be talking about some Phish holiday run shows. We're going to be talking about Christmas music. It's going to be a fun episode. Something to help you guys as you're driving home for the holidays or waiting in airports that are stocked with people or trying to deal with your uncle who keeps railing about some certain politicians in the White House.
Yeah, this is an episode to kick back in an easy chair. Maybe on Christmas Eve there's some snow outside. Maybe you've got some mulled wine. You're in front of a crackling fire. There's some Christmas music in the background or beyond the pond. This is try to drink in the Christmas spirit. And on that note, let's get to some Phish.
So like we said at the top here, we're going to talk about a couple different things. We're going to focus initially on some underrated holiday shows from Phish's New Year's runs with the 2017 New Year's run looming. We wanted to focus on a couple shows that have fallen under the radar over the years but are definitely worth your time and get you into the Christmas spirit. We are also going to talk about some underrated holiday songs, some songs that should go on your Christmas playlist as you are getting sick and tired of hearing the same old stuff year after year as you're walking in and out of department stores and going to Christmas parties and whatnot. But we're going to talk about two shows that I think both of us quite enjoy. We've listened to over the last few days. The first is going to be December 30th, 1995 from Madison Square Garden. And then we're going to follow that up with December 29th, 1996 from the Spectrum in Philadelphia. So kicking things off with 12/30/95. So this is a show that's really interesting. This was bookended by, I would say, I think that you would agree with me, Dave, two of the strongest shows in not only Phish holiday run history, but overall Phish history. And as a result, 12/30/95 is pretty overshadowed and definitely been overlooked. What are your thoughts on this show?
No, certainly it's a very high quality show. I think it's probably the weakest of the four-night run, which is still at such an incredibly high level that it's all quite relative.
Yeah.
But I was at, let's see, my 16-year-old self was found a way to get to 12/28/95 and 12/29/95, of course, being the incredible Real Gin, Bathtub Gin, Real Mean to Bathtub Gin show.
What
in retrospect, my God. In retrospect, it's pretty incredible that my parents let me go to Worcester, Massachusetts and sleep on some strange woman's floor and then go to these two shows. Granted, I was with some other friends and I knew them all from like Jewish youth groups or whatnot, but still, thank you, Mom and Dad. I very much appreciate you letting me do that.
There are a couple shows for all of our parents to that we should thank them for. Vegas 04 is it for me. I mean, not the greatest shows, but I don't know how my parents allowed a 19-year-old kid to drive to Las Vegas for three nights of fish debauchery.
Jesus Christ. You were 19. Oh, you're a baby. 19.
I was a little kid. I couldn't grow a beard. So 12:30, you know, obviously this is the band's second show at Madison Square Garden. You can hear the energy right from the start. The first set is filled with heavy hitters. You've got Bowie and Divided Sky. You've got setlist oddities that really keep it surprising and really fresh sounding every single time you hear it. You know, I think you and I talked about this a little bit before recording. It's less notable of a first set for any sort of exploration. I mean, Bowie itself is 15 minutes, but it's a pretty straightforward version. It's really just a torrid version going forward.
Yeah, it's a very good 15-minute first set Bowie. It isn't anything like the Big Summer 95 Bowies. Yeah. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah, and it kind of by that point in fall of 95, I mean, obviously 12/11/95 has a really good 25-minute version, but they started to kind of focus Bowie a little bit more, which you would see over the course of the next year before it expanded again in 97. But really, this set is notable for unique placements of really good songs, and sometimes that's all you need. Sometimes all right. That's all you want. Doesn't always need to go type 2. And you get a really unique Caspian opener. That's one of my personal favorite slots for the song. And I like how this works similarly to how it worked on 7/31/15 in Atlanta. It sets the tone perfectly. It's very much of a slow burn. It kind of walks you into the show right, really nicely.
And that was the second Caspian opener. The first one I saw on December 2nd, 1995, from New Haven. I don't love these Caspian openers because they're really short, and it's the two-chord version of Caspian. I thought the song was kind of cheeseball at the time. Mm-hmm. Clearly, as you know, it's gotten far more fleshed out. I think an opener would be kind of cool nowadays, but I mostly thought, oh, they open with Caspian again. That was lame back on December 2nd, and it's lame now.
So you follow really quickly that up with 2001 Into Susie Into Bowie, which as a 2-3-4 slot as a show is just a shot of a total adrenaline. You're 15 minutes in the show, you're deep in a Bowie jam. I mean, it's the blistering 95 heat that they used to just bring into shows.
Susie, 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 Susie what's interesting with this 2001, I think it's only about 5 minutes long. And for Fall 1997, if you've been following on Twitter, we've been doing the Fall 97 Twitter deep dive. And every 2001 from Fall 97 is like 14 minutes with like Superbad and James Brown teases.
Right.
So it was interesting to go back to this one and think, oh, okay, there was a time when it wasn't 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear 2001 that almost sounds like new age, or like it's really danceable in like a Talking Heads type of manner, rather than that like slow funk groove that you would get right in 97. You move from there into Simple, It's Ice, into Kung, back into It's Ice. I mean, this for me is the type of setlist jamming oddity that marks a truly great show. Stuff that's just unexpected. You're never really going to see it placed like that again. Although Kung very seamlessly slots itself in the middle of Its Ice. I'm surprised that they haven't done that more often. But were one of the shows around this less significant, you can be, you know, sure people would be talking about this excellent first set much more. It's really a first set that just falls under the radar. Simply, like we were saying, based on the merits of 12/29/95 and 12/31, which a lot of people would argue is the best Phish show that's ever been played. So
yeah,
it's understandable this has been overlooked, but really, really just good stuff here. Very creative. I mean, for me, it's the setlist oddities, it's the speed that they're playing, the creativity that they're playing on a note-to-note basis. I just love it.
Yeah, it's worth noting in 1995 that Trey could play It's Ice very fast and with no mistakes.
Right.
Like, to me, that's one of the more difficult Phish songs to play from Mike Gordon's, like, Benny Hill Show style bass line to, I mean, Trey, the guitar licks are just, it's a very, very, very intricate song. And in 95, they could play it faster than the version on Rift and really precise. And I think these days they have to slow it down to about Rift speed, and Trey can get about 75% of it.
I mean, it's really interesting when you think about them at this period in time. You know, when they walk off the stage on December 31st, 1995, and by that point, the early morning hours of 1996, they're not going to be heard from again in a live setting until late April. And then they're from there going to go to Europe in the summer, but they're going to play a very short U.S. tour in the summer that leads to the Clifford Ball. And then by that era's standings, a very, very short fall tour in 96, which would then be the kind of tone over the next couple of years towards the latter end of 1.0.
Right.
And I say all this because, you know, you talk about the speed that Trey is playing with. You look at 92, 93, 94, and 95, they're playing well over 100 shows a year. They're playing tours that are 3-4 months long. I mean, you can hear it in this show. Even if this is a slightly off night or a lower tier night of a 4-night run, the band is so connected. Like, it's like they can just communicate without any sort of effort. And you hear right. it in something like this, It's Ice.
No, it's... They were incredibly locked in. I think at this point, they're all maybe like 30, 31 years old.
Yeah.
So they're still relatively young and on fire and just peaking.
Following up with that, the man who stepped in yesterday, always great old school Phish. You expect during a holiday run. To me, and this is kind of something I've been thinking about the last couple of days we've been planning for this, I think of holiday runs in the same way as I think of the holiday season, as I, you know, think of Christmas. You expect it to be kind of a peek back into the formative moments of the band. It's a time where they feel this, like, warmth of the fan base. You know, they feel the warmth of the season. They're open to spilling their souls a little bit. You get these shows during the holiday runs, and I'm thinking about 12, 30, 97, but I'm also thinking about, like, 12, 30, 2009, when they busted out a bunch of songs in the first set.
Is that when they played, like, Gone?
Yeah, yeah, and they played...
It was, like, some songs off, like, the Party Time, Disc 2.
Yeah, yeah,
right,
throughout
right.
that. But, you know, there's, I think, 12-28, 2012 in the same sort of way. Like, the way that Wolfman's Brother goes into the, I believe it's the Little Drummer Boy jam.
Yeah.
It feels like old-school gimmickry Phish. And it feels like a band that is just comfortable at that point in time. They're looking back reflectively on a year of music. It's not as much as though they're, like, pushing forward their sound at this point in time. They're more celebrating what the sound was that they created over the past 12 months, as well as, you know, taking a second to reflect on where they how they've gotten at this point in their career. And I feel right. like, you know, you throw a song like The Man Who Stepped In Yesterday out there, you get that. That's like, that's the origins of Phish. And then to follow it up with Divided Sky, song that, you know, pretty much every version from 94 through 96 is big and perfect. I mean, that just cements it from a just really emotive and big, you know, Phish historical standpoint.
And then Sample Set Closer, right?
Sample Set Closer, which I'm fine with it in that.
That's room. Fine in that slot. It's yeah. great in the set closing spot.
It's a good
F yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking Alehu, man. So... The second set of this show, it's not quite as cohesive as set one, but it contains what we think could be the best version of Harry Hood the band's ever played. I mean,
I would say so.
Certainly the best one to not fully go outside the box. Certainly the best, like, type one, the archetype of, like, a type one 15-minute Harry Hood. Like, it doesn't... They don't change keys. They don't really... you know, play entirely different melodies, doesn't get dissonant. It's not like, you know, say 2000, like summer 2003, like 28-minute version of Harry Hood. This is a compact 15-minute version, and yet relative to other ones from the era. I mean, to me, this one, it feels like it's like sprinkled with fairy dust.
Yeah.
I just listened to it. I pictured the Keebler Elves running around making EL fudge.
I mean, I've always read that, I've read on message boards and I've read on Twitter that everyone who was in the building at this point felt that like something really celebratory and really, really big happened, you know, in like a kind of fish magical way. And you hear it towards the latter end of the jam when they're bringing it back around to You Can Feel Good chorus. It's the only moment where Trey kind of alternates from the hood peak. And it's almost as though he's just like riding back and forth on a couple of different notes really quickly to just hold them at that sustain point. And it's like they just know that they had reached this level where everybody was waiting for the release, and he just wanted to hold it, hold that tension just, you know, a minute or so longer. And it just adds a little bit to the jam that, like, it, for me, it's, you know, your fist starts pumping. You get that like shit-eating grin on your face every time you hear it. It's really what is perfect about that jam. It just it's an elated moment. just you're taking the 12/31/93 hood and you're adding the talent and strength of a band in December 1995, which, you know, you can subjectively, obviously, there's reason to love 93 versus 1995, but, you know, they're just a stronger overall band at, you know, 2 years later. They've been playing that much longer and they've been exploring that much more, that much deeper. So that's a ridiculous jam.
Yeah. Just want to take a second to talk about the free in this set, which I really like.
Totally.
Because on the soundboard, you can hear Trey audibly count it off coming out of Yamar, which is neat. And then you just hit that huge D major chord. And Fishman's drumming, it's so locked in, and it feels like a march. It feels like a little faster than the average free.
Right.
And I'm kind of of the mind that free never got better after 1995. And I prefer the psychedelic droning midsection as opposed to what it is now, which is like the wah solo leads into the Trey soloing. I didn't think it was broken. They tried to fix it anyway. I'm not sure it was worth it.
Right.
And take a moment to point out how incredibly different that the version from Billy Breed's is versus any live version of the song. I think the one in Billy Breed's was recorded in E major, even though the song has never not been played in D. You can't hear the lead riff in the Billy Breed's version. That was the first one to introduce the wah solo, which leads me to believe that I think Steve Lillywhite fucked up free for them. He was like, no, guys, do it like this. And they listened.
Second set, you know, beyond free, beyond Harry Hood, it's kind of hit or miss. There's a AC/DC bag in the middle of it. There's a scent of
pretty good scent of mule.
Pretty good, but, you know, for mid second set, it's just kind of a placement. I personally would never really want it in.
No.
Cavern, I think, is in there, Run Like an Antelope. I mean, it's not exactly a second set you draw up, and when you think about the second set from the following night or the second set from the previous night, really has no comparison. It's all about this Harry Hood.
You're there for the hood.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, for me, 12/30 is my single favorite date of the year for Phish, and this show and the Harry Hood and the first set really showcase why that is. you know, 1230-93, 1230-97. These are two of my favorite Phish shows of all time. 1230-97 is actually my favorite Phish show that the band has ever played.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's just it's got
top
everything.
10 for me, easy.
But yeah. It's got everything I want. It's got a huge bust out. It's got great jamming. It's got the AC/DC bag that opens things up. When Tom Marshall comes out and sings 500 Miles, I mean, that's what I was talking about earlier in terms of like peeking back into the history of Phish, like something that can only be done at a holiday run. The encore that goes on forever. I mean, that's a show that I could talk about for hours.
I remember that show. I was not there, but I was going to visit a friend at Ithaca College, which was about a 6-hour drive from where I was. I remember pulling into the parking lot outside of her dorm, and like right before turning off the car, like the encore of the 1230-97 show ended. So It stopped, turned the car off. I'm like, all right, that was great. Yeah.
Fast forwarding to 3.0, two of the best shows I've ever seen are 1230-2012 and 1230-2016. I don't know if I've ever been more excited walking into a single show than I was on December 30th, 2012, just because I knew I'm going to see Phish at MSG on December 30th, like the historical ramifications. And it was a great show. Excellent Carini that we covered a long, long time ago in this show. Great Down with Disease. The aforementioned shows, 1230-99, 1230-03, 1230-09, 1230-15 is a solid show for the holiday run opener.
Bathtub Gin, right, my God.
Great gin, great chocolate like torture. Well,
Kraut Rock, like Wilco Spiders, Bathtub Gin.
Yes.
1230-15.
And these are just, I mean, they're some of the strongest shows the band's ever played. To me, when you go onto the Phish OD app on 1230 and you see all these shows that are listed there, I just get giddy because there's just so much to hear.
Notice how you do not mention 1230-96.
Or 1230-2011.
Yeah, that's okay.
That show was offensively awful.
Okay, so now we're actually going to talk about December 29th, 1996, from the Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That building has since been demolished. Now it's home to a large bar/kind of sports viewing area called Xfinity Live. That's where you want to go if you want to pick a fight with some really belligerent Philadelphia Flyers fans. So 1229 was far and away the strongest show of the 1996 New Year's run. But whereas December 30th, 1995 is overshadowed by the two very strong shows around it, 1229 is weighed down by an overall weak New Year's Eve run. Clearly, strongest here is a relative term. We'd say 1996 is probably the weakest New Year's Eve run not named 2011.
Yeah, it's almost here like they reverted back to the beginning of Fall 96 as opposed to the end. The set lists are very static. They sound exactly like they look on paper. There's very minimal improv throughout. I should note 1228-96 contains a very, very excellent Mike song in a strange design in a Weekapaw groove. But that show overall, I'm not too huge on. And 1230-96, I know I've never made it all the way through. And 1231-96, I haven't really, I think I probably listened to it once. I think I've listened to every New Year's show at least once. But yeah, not the strongest run overall. Very similar to 2011 in that sense.
I was actually at December 30th and December 31st. I had fun, but a 17-year-old in Boston without parental supervision would be expected to have fun.
Yes.
It's a whole lot of stories that won't make the podcast, unfortunately. But on December 30th, for some reason, Phish tickets by mail, they ended up giving me seats that were in like a more luxurious part of the Fleet Center. That resulted in we got to eat fruit-blended frozen yogurt that we'd even have to pay for because I guess it was included in the ticket prices. I don't know. Aside from a decent tweezer, and the band doing some funny things when the PA cut out during Funky Bitch. And I guess, what's his name, Stephen Wright, the very deadpan comic, got to ring a bell during Center for Mule. But man, 12/30/96 sucks.
So in terms of 12/29, the night before here at the Spectrum, part of the reason we selected this, I mean, the first set, you get a really unique quartet opening of Poor Heart, Caravan, Cavern, and Taste. So I just listened to it today, and the LaGrange set closer for the first set of the show is just so rocking, and they sound so into it, and Mike does the voice perfectly. It's one of those songs that I feel like they've played it once, if not twice, in 3.0. I think SPAC 2012 got a LaGrange, I could be wrong, but man, oh man, oh man, that would be just a great cover to bring back. Set two, it's hard to come up with, you can obviously come up with better set lists on paper, but putting Bowie, Lizards, Bathtub Gin, You Enjoy Myself, and Harpua in a second set, that's, you know, throwing down some pretty good, playing with some house money right there.
Yeah, I would say nothing in this set is worse than good. There's a dearth of, like, type two antics, aside from... Yes. The wacky rotation jamming in a very fast version of You Enjoy Myself. The lack of any real fireworks at all in the Bathtub Gin is a little confusing considering the barn burner version they played exactly 1 year ago and considering how friggin' good most Fall 96 gins were.
Thank you.
What's interesting about the Harpua, when they play Champagne Supernova as being Tom Marshall being the uber demon singing the sounds of hell, but I think they realize that Champagne Supernova is actually a good song. I mean, albeit it was completely played to death in the radio in 1996, Trey bothers to get both the chords and the guitar tone right, and Tom Marshall really makes an effort at nailing like Liam Gallagher's Manchester accent. That song, it's a high-quality tune released at the height of the Britpop craze. Radio wouldn't touch it nowadays. I mean, you don't know what you got until it's gone, but I ride for that second Oasis album, so...
kind of thinking, you know, with the Shine version from New Year's Eve 95, this Champagne Supernova from 96, the band had an opportunity here to start a really cool trend of playing a song that had just been played to death on the radio at the New Year's Eve show as kind of like a celebratory gimmick. What do we think they would do going forward throughout the 90s?
Well, let's see. 1997, they could have done Semi-Charmed Life, which makes me kind of stabby, but, you know.
But it was everywhere in 97,
yeah.
Right? And, I mean, wouldn't you love to hear Tom do some doot, doot, doot and try to rap that?
No.
98, I kind of thought Candle in the Wind. That was pretty much everywhere with Elton John with that song. 99, Every Morning. You remember that song from Sugar Ray?
That was 99? Yeah, I guess I was in college. That song was huge. That was the big post-Fly hit, I guess.
Yeah, they, what did they name their record? 1459.
As yes.
15 Minutes of Fame was just about up. And
let me tell you, that guy, Martin McGrath, after seeing him on like Rock and Roll Jeopardy, I've got so much respect for him. He, like, ran the table every episode of Rock and Roll Jeopardy he was on.
He's actually got a really good sense of humor. I got to give him to him for that. I mean, he is...
He was pretty self-aware.
Jumping ahead, so no... So 99, we would have Every Morning. I guess that would be an appropriate song as the sun's coming up at Big Cypress.
Oh, shit.
But 2002 would have to be Hot in Here by Nelly.
And Fishman.
You could have Fishman do that. What would we have in 2003?
I guess Hey Ya.
Hey Ya probably would be it. That was the winner of my freshman year of college, and that song was at every single party I went to. Jumping ahead, you get into 3.0, and reverting here back to some rock and roll, I guess you could say Use Somebody by the Kings of Leon was everywhere at that point in time.
Hmm. I don't mind the first three records. They're actually pretty good. But by the time I used Somebody, it was not so good.
Every time I heard that song on, that was, I feel like, the last era where I listened to the radio at any point in time. And I feel like I just changed the channel immediately. 2010, Hey Soul Sister by Train. This is a song I would never, ever, ever want to hear Phish play. But I do remember, like, this was in, like, 80 commercials in 2010.
Fuck Train.
That's all I got to say about that.
Yep.
2011, there's two missed opportunities here for this song. So, Firework by Katy Perry.
And it could have been, like, Hold Your Head Up into Firework and Hold Your Head Up with Fishbin, but I think they actually did I Kissed a Girl at one point. So that kind of, they got the Carrie, they got the Katy Perry quotient done with that.
I think there's the jam, the Down with Disease jam from Dick's 2015 that has what sounds faintly like a Firework jam. So I've got to imagine that they've at least listened to the song and are fans of it. And it is a great building pop song.
But the biggest, I think the biggest Phish missed opportunity was in 2012, which not bringing out Tom Marshall to sing like Gautier is somebody that I used to know. That was a huge miss.
And it's right in his vocal range. I feel like he would have yeah, nailed it perfectly.
Exactly. It would have actually sounded good. That's not a bad song.
No, that song rules. No.
It's a weird one-hit wonder, but it's a good song.
Yeah, I didn't go out and buy the record, but every time it came on in a bar, I did not mind it at all.
No.
It was kind of one of those songs that really leveled the playing field. Like, there really weren't a lot of people that hated it other than just, like, true haters.
Right. But, no, definitely Tom Marshall doing, like, the, you didn't have to come here. That's... God, that should have happened.
We knew we were going to get singing in this episode. I didn't know it was going to be at this point, but that's great.
2013, Blurred Lines, which yeah, Trey liked because he heard it in his kid's car.
Song was everywhere. I don't think that would translate very well about 4 years later just in the current climate that we're in.
No, that's a song God, no.
That, we are not advocating for that song to be played. We're just kind of musing over what would have fit this this bill. 2014 would have to go with a song like Happy by...
right.
That is a song I'm not a huge fan of. It doesn't really make me happy, but I know that there's a lot of people that quite enjoy it.
In 2015, certainly Uptown Funk. Pretty good song. Big knockoff of Moore's Day and the Times version of mid-80s Minneapolis funk. Yes. But in and of itself...
That's fine. Basically just Bruno Mars's career, though.
Yeah.
And he does a really good job of it.
Yeah, Bruno Mars is an excellent copyist.
Yes. And then I was trying to do some research on what 2016, 2017 would be. I don't know if becoming a father has just meant that I don't have any idea what the kids are listening to these days, or if rock music has really folded into... the counterculture once again, and it's just not the mainstream. That there's not really a song that would be fitting for Phish to do.
I'm thinking of like songs of the summer, stuff that like owned the radio in 2016 and 2017. There wasn't much I could come up with. I think mostly because you and I were listening to not so much the pop radio stations, but it seems like the one ubiquitous song might not have been as prevalent the past 2 years.
Yeah, I really am at a loss. You should add us, fair listener, if you have a song that would fit this list of 2016-2017. Think song that was everywhere, a song that you heard everywhere that would be just hilarious to see Phish play, and preferably would be hilarious to see Tom Marshall sing.
Mm.
But getting back to the show, thank you for indulging with us there. overall... 12/29/96 here it's just a really great example of the energy and excitement and history and gimmickry that one wants in a New Year's Eve show. It goes back to what I was saying earlier. You want that harpua. You want harpua to follow you, enjoy myself. Like, that's really defining that you're at a special New Year's Eve show just before the end of the year. And, you know, for what it's worth, I think that 12/29 is really the only date that can really rival 12/30 for the overall historical consistency and the ability to conjure up the magic one expects with a New Year's Eve run Phish show. You've got 12/29/94 with a massive Bowie, 12-29-95, like we were talking about earlier. 97 has that excellent second set with great tube, great Bowie. First set's got amazing Antelope. 12-29-98, one of my favorite New Year's Eve run shows. That second set is just perfect note for note. 03 in Miami. 09's got a great tweezer in it and was a really great, another like big benchmark show as Phish was returning in there in 3.0. And then 2013, that's my favorite show of 2013, 12-29-13, the Down with Disease.
That was the only one it wasn't at.
Oh, man, I love that show.
Yeah, it, no, that's, that was the best show of the run. It wasn't there.
Yeah, that show feels like if Phish wasn't such a prolific live band, that show feels like a live album to me. Like they purposely recorded this show to release to be like, hey, this is a capture of who we are.
The Disease-arini set too.
Yeah, yeah.
Really awesome.
It's one of those shows, the audience recording, you know, we're so spoiled here in 3.0 where so many, where all the shows are available on Soundboard, but that's one of the few 3.0 shows that I solely listen to the audio because Mike's bass during that Down with Disease, you just hear it reverberate throughout MSG and the crowd just blow up over it, and then they return to the Disease riff, which I love when that happens every time. All right, so transitioning here into I guess the main part of the podcast, I don't know. We're going to talk about holiday music right now, something that I don't think we ever really thought we were going to talk about. We threw this idea about this podcast around kind of as a joke for a couple of months, and then we're like, ah, screw it, let's do it. So we're just going to talk about, in the most nostalgic sense possible, this is obviously a very warm and nostalgic type of time of year, what our favorite holiday albums are. So mine, a favorite holiday record of all time is Andy Williams, the Andy Williams Christmas album. It is as Norman Rockwell American as it gets. But my God, no matter what, this record makes me feel like it's Christmas morning and I'm 10 years old. There's just perfect ease and a bell-like quality to Andy Williams' voice. There's nothing about this album that's offensive or intentionally off-kilter. And as a result, I think it's probably the nicest record that any of us have featured on Beyond the Pond to this point. It's really perfect in the way that a Lexus commercial perfectly displays wealthy exurbs, like people living in the wealthy exurbs of cities. I probably listen to this album like 20 or 30 times every Christmas season. It's in the background if I'm cooking or if I'm like shopping for Christmas presents online. I throw this on just to get myself in the holiday spirit. Wrapping presents. It's played by my parents incessantly during the holidays. I'm going home here the weekend before Christmas, and I'm going to hear this album over and over and over again. It's like all my dad wants to listen to over Christmas. I will never get sick of this album. Every time I put it on, it gives me the exact same feeling that I want every time I hear it. But I will never listen to it outside of the month of December. I have no interest in ever hearing this record in January or in June, for that matter. Breaking it down, and you know, I was kind of thinking about this like we think about a lot of our albums here on Beyond the Pond. Side A, you got the hits. You got White Christmas. You got Happy Holidays, the most wonderful time of the year, Jingle Bells. Side B is really where it's at for me. This is the contemplative slow burners that fit the mood when you've had just a bit too much glug. You're sitting in front of the tree, the lights are on, you're gazing into it for some meaning. It's got Noel, Oh Holy Night, Silent Night. I mean, these are just the holiday songs that just get me in that kind of lulled out, slightly drunk, nostalgic sense. It really represents everything you want from Christmas break now as an adult.
My Simpsons fandom, and for the other Simpsons fans on the podcast, I am obligated to say I didn't think he was gonna do it, but Moon River second encore. That's what I think of when I think of Andy Williams. But he had a great theater in Branson, Missouri. He died in 2012. He even had like a golf tournament for many years in San Diego. Dang.
I learned it about him in researching for this episode.
Right.
Die hard, bleeding heart liberal.
Mm.
I would have taken him as conservative as it comes, but he was close friends with Robert Kennedy. He spoke out actively against President Nixon. He was very much an anti-war musician. He was... I love him that much more now that I know all that about him. Fall on your knees. Oh, hear the angel voices. Oh, night divine. Oh, night when Christ was born.
So the album I'm going to pick here is because, truth be told, there wasn't a ton of Christmas music growing up in a Reformed Jewish household in Central Connecticut. But I'm going to say a Charlie Brown Christmas, because I did watch a ton of Peanuts on VHS growing up. Many, many viewings of Charlie Brown's Christmas with Charlie Brown's anemic Christmas tree, the really cool skating scene. And everything else, it's a very warm, fuzzy escape from the world for about 40 minutes. And the Vince Guaraldi Trio, the piano jazz soundtrack, it's equal parts legendary and soothing. You know, I want to listen to it in front of a crackling fire, with snow falling down, gripping a mug of something sweet and vaguely alcoholic. The song Linus and Lucy, which you all know that's on here. The soundtrack to the skating scene, which is... basically just like jazzy music perfectly emulating a snowfall that's on here. And that scene and the music were amazingly parodied in an early South Park Christmas episode. Really, no one dislikes this album. It's the full moon fever of Christmas jazz. I think I played it like 3 or 4 times this week. And it's it should be, portions of it should be on every pleasant Christmas playlist, I think. So, for segueing to our next segment, we're going to discuss some overlooked holiday songs. Not so much overlooked as maybe not the first things that come to mind when you think of holiday music. So, Brian, what do you got?
So, my first selection is from Willie Nelson. It's a lead track off of his 1979 album, Pretty Paper. The song is called Pretty Paper. This is Willie's first Christmas album, and it was a song that he'd originally written in 1963 and recorded in 1964, but that Roy Orbison had actually turned into a hit. Nelson wrote this song about a street vendor who sold wrapping paper and pens and pencils during the Christmas season down in Fort Worth, Texas. The man had his legs amputated, and he moved on rollers. And to attract attention to people, to buy his products, he would actually shout out, "Pretty paper, pretty paper." The man's identity was revealed actually in 2013. It's a guy by the name of Frankie Bearton, and it was revealed that he had refused to use a wheelchair, instead opting to crawl as he learned to move growing up with a spinal deficiency. He didn't want to adjust the way that he had been moving his whole childhood. Interestingly, song Pretty Paper when it was recorded by Roy Orbison. He did it in one take. He was battling 102 fever. So this was, like I said, Willie Nelson's first Christmas record. It was his last album of the 70s. It is a charmer, as one would expect, and across 12 songs, he charts the Christmas season with his affable wilt, his wit, his very down-home personality. It's not the perfect Christmas album. I think that there are better versions of these Christmas classics, but it's absolutely a wonderful one to drink some whiskey to, and I hope that you enjoy Pretty Paper.
Pretty paper, pretty ribbons blue. Wrap your presents to your darling from you. Pretty pencils to write I love you. Pretty paper, pretty ribbons of blue. Crowded streets, busy feet hustle by. Downtown shoppers, Christmas is nigh. There he sits, all alone on the sidewalk, hoping that you won't pass him by.
Should you start? All right, Brian, thanks for that song. I know that's a record with which I am pretty familiar. I've actually have it on cassette. It's my wife's late aunt and uncle. They had that album on cassette, and we, when we were cleaning out their property, we found a copy of it and spirited away to our apartment. So, the song I'm next and going to discuss is from a power pop band from New Jersey called Fountains of Wayne. They're probably their best song could be Radiation Vibe, but they're a consummate 2000s, late 90s power pop band, and the song is called Alien for Christmas. This is a tune from their 2005 B-Sides compilation Out of State Plates, and this is basically the type of chipper, perfectly produced power pop song that these guys can bang out in their sleeve. Really, this is a silly, catchy, effortless holiday song, and really, like, sterling power pop bands like Fountains of Wayne, I mean, they don't really exist nowadays. If they do, listener, let me know where I can get a band that's as well produced. Certainly Fountains of Wayne's 2003 album Welcome Interstate Managers is probably my pick for best produced power pop album ever, and they've yet to top it, and they probably won't, because that was Interstate Managers was their third and easily best album. And they also had the mediocre Traffic and Weather in 2007 and the somewhat more adult Sky Full of Holes in 2011. And if the band kind of seems to be more or less on extended hiatus, it's largely because the producer and bass player named Adam Schlesinger, he does 800 other things, ranging from he produces other albums, he does soundtrack, and he also has a hand in writing almost all the songs on the fantastic CW TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Probably, I would say that's one of my five favorite shows on TV today. But he's the bass player. Chris Collinwood does the guitar and singing in the band. I know he has some solo projects. But really, the Adam Schlesinger production style is lush. It emphasizes vocals. He loves using Moog keyboards. There's a Moog solo on this song, and it's, you know, just a very effortless, friendly power pop song about getting an alien for Christmas. And let's play it.
I want an alien for Christmas. In the spring, I'll always keep him company. He'll never
catch the twilight zone. I want an alien for Christmas.
All right. So moving right along here, we're going to switch things up a bit from power pop to very heavy 80s hair metal Christmas. We're going to feature the guitarist George Lynch and his song Christmas Sarajevo 1224. This song, it's like Hey You meets Joe Satriani meets God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen meets the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. This is, I think, the type of music that really up until a couple of years ago, I would have just despised and I would have scoffed at. But I really find both the humor, the over-the-top aspect to this, the guitar wizardry and technical precision of it just blows me away. This is actually a really excellent Christmas song. I keep listening to it over and over again. It's ultra sincere. It's shameless. It's total Christmas kitsch. But these guitar lines, they sound like plastic. They rip through your gut. The piano is played with unrestrained passion, and the sound builds through peak after peak after peak. I mean, you talk about tension and release, and you get that in this song completely. This is, to me, the gaudy white elephant gift you're secretly thrilled to receive at your office party. This is an excellent, excellent Christmas song. So George Lynch is a legendary hard rock guitarist, originally of the band Dokken, and since the mid-90s, the Lynch Mob. Notably, he was named the 68th greatest guitarist by Guitar World magazine and the 10th greatest metal guitarist by Gibson Guitars. He apparently taught Eddie Van Halen how to play the two-tap on guitar. And in recent years, this is quite interesting, he's pioneered documentaries focusing on the plight and overall impact of the destruction of native rights and opportunities, which finding out that our Christmas musical heroes are bleeding heart liberals is really just becoming a good new drinking game for me.
And not only is he a bleeding heart liberal, but he's like the Hakeem Olajuwon of guitar.
Yeah,
he swoops and dives and grabs for things. He's, you know, George Lynch is he's far better than any 80s hair metal guitarist has a right to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally true. The Hakeem, there's a gracefulness about what he does. Like, he attacks the guitar with total precision and power, but like a butterfly, like how Hakeem was. So I love yes. that image of it. Yeah, I like I said, this type of music is not really my wheelhouse, but it's really something I'm loving a lot, and I think that you will, I think all of our listeners will find something to enjoy about this, be it the over the top kitsch of it or the just fantastic guitar lines that you know, in some cases could remind you of One Trey Anastasio. So here's Christmas Sarajevo 1224 by George Lynch.
Okay, so at this point, we're going to take a brief hiatus from the holiday songs and going to talk about two albums that did not make our top 10 list, maybe did not make our honorable mentions. These are our 2017 late bloomers. These are albums that kind of, they required several listens for us to fully grasp the quality, and as such, may not have made a list. And the album that I'm going to talk about its latest record, which came out in October from St. Vincent, called Mass Seduction. Now, St. Vincent, that's the rock and roll name for Andy Clark, and she's a heck of an artist. She's, I guess her stock in trade is, I guess I would call it, like electro pop balladry with a very unique blend of like skronky guitar outbursts. She's kind of a 21st century guitar hero. Lots of dissonance and noise, and she's always backed by sort of like an electronic drum soundscape. And she's a great lyricist and very excellent vocalist. Plus, she also changes up her aesthetics with every album cycle. It's kind of, you know, people call her almost kind of like a relative to David Bowie, in the sense that with every album, it's not just an album. It's a whole different look. It's a whole different feel. And so I really loved her third and fourth album, third album being Strange Mercy. The fourth was the self-titled. And at first, the album Mass Seduction seemed a little too slick and vapid for its own good. It seemed to be her most poppy album. And not for nothing, she recorded it with Jack Antonoff, who, he also, he's worked with a lot of poppy women as of late. He was recorded Lord's Melodrama, which is fantastic. He also recorded the latest Taylor Swift album, which I don't quite love as much. And both Lord and Taylor Swift are generally thought of as more mainstream than St. Vincent. So we figured this was going to be like, St. Vincent's kind of bid for mainstream acceptance. And, but the more I listened to it and sort of took it in as a whole, I began to realize that it really does stand up against her best work. What's interesting is that the best songs, I think, are the last three songs in the album, being Young Lover, Slow Disco, and Smoking Section. It kind of ends on a very dramatic, very high note. And recently, I saw her play it live. Her, in the past, when she's played live, she's had a band. But on the most recent tour behind the Mass Seduction album, it's kind of like she plays two sets. The first set is sort of like greatest hits, and the second set is Mass Seduction front to back. And it's only her playing guitar to sort of like a live, loud backing track. And each song has like movies and there's costume changes. And it kind of felt more like an art exhibit than a proper rock show, but it was still really great in context. And, you know, it takes a lot of faith to believe enough in your new album to play it front to back 2 months after it's been released.
Yeah.
But after having seen it done, you know, I realized it was very good. The aesthetic was very realized. And, I'm still listening to that album quite a bit now. And I think that had I had a bit more time, it probably would have cracked my top 10 easily.
So I've got a record that... similarly, early on in this year, this record came out kind of midway through 2017 and didn't really connect with me until the last couple of months. This is Kevin Morby's City Music. So interestingly, Singing Saw, his record from 2016, was my number one album of the year. And so I had very high hopes for this record when it was announced. And then in addition, I saw Kevin Morby at the Rock and Roll Hotel in DC in May. It was an excellent show. The new songs were great live. Come to Me Now, City Music, which was the opener with him dancing in the middle of it, and like kind of the breakdown area section of it. Song Nighttime, Pearly Gates, and especially the album's closer, Downtown's Lights. These were real standouts from the show overall. Notably as well, the encore was Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground. It was the first time that he had played it live, and this was just a great cap to one of my first shows of the year, and great little bit of pre-Baker's Dozen fish geekery, and I'm quite certain I was the only person at the show jumping up and down and screaming every lyric. I probably got quite a few awkward looks, but hey, when you hear a song that Fish plays on a regular basis live, it's basically a Fish song to me at this point in time, you're going to act appropriately. And then Dorothy closed out the show in full, and that was my favorite song off of Singing Saw. So really, really had every reason to love this album when it came out. So why didn't it make my top 20? I'm not really sure. It was released in mid-June, which was at a time when I slightly burnt myself out on new listens. I was starting to return to some of my favorite records of the year at that point in time, and wasn't really moving towards like discovering albums for a little bit of time. Plus, Fish Tour was right around the corner. I just kind of faded at that point from listening to new records for a few weeks, and was listening to a lot of Baker's Dozen shows, and Fish did a great tour this summer, so I kind of stopped, you know, I had to do a big refresh after the end of the Baker's Dozen. So it just kind of got overshadowed, whereas Singing Saw hit me at the right time in 2016 and never had a chance to really leave my top five and ended up in my top one. City Music was really released at an inopportune time and was overshadowed by later big records like The War on Drugs or The National Sleepwell Beast, Gang of Youths, records that came out towards the end, later part of the year that really took up a lot of time for me. But like I said, this has come around to me a lot in the last month or two. It's very much of a fall driving record. It's very contemplative. It's slow drifting. It's probably his most Dylan record to date. Really feels like an early 70s Dylan LP to me. And really just kind of showcases the diversity of where Morby's going with his songwriting. There's a lot of odes to kind of past artists. There's a very nostalgic feel in this. There's very much of a road trip vibe in it. And I'm actually going on a pretty big road trip here in the next week, driving back to Chicago. And I know I'll be playing this record at least once on the drive. And
you're driving?
Yeah.
We're not flying?
Nice. No, we're doing the drive, bringing the dog, getting the station wagon and driving to Chicago. It's the Clark Griswold moment for me every year. But yeah, no, really been liking this record. And I would say if you've liked anything that Morby has done in the past, Harlem River, Singing Saw, give this one a couple more tries. It definitely connects after a few listens.
All right. Now, for our final segment of this evening, I'm going to do some more overlooked holiday songs. So the song I'm going to discuss here is Greensleeves, which in of itself is not that overlooked. But this version is by Jimmy Smith, the classic organ player who I think we've mentioned on this podcast before in one context or another. So I'm going to talk about his version of Greensleeves, which comes on his Organ Grinder Swing album. He recorded for Verve Records in 1965 in a trio with Kenny Burrell on guitar and Grady Tate on drums. And I'm probably going to guess this is not the only version of Greensleeves that he recorded, but it's certainly the one that I'm most familiar with. And it's really only kind of Greensleeves in the most loose sense of the word, in the sense that he really toys with the melody at the head of the song before just, you know, going off in any variety of ways. And, of course, the Hammond B3 organ, that's his main instrument. This is some very torrid organ jazz. And this entire album, the Organ Grinder Swing album, the whole thing is good. And most of the albums he recorded for Verve in the late 60s feature big bands. So, you know, the ability to hear him in a trio setting is a treat, and the album really maintains a very smoky jazz club ambience throughout. I know, I think 2 years later in 67 is when he would record his famous albums with Wes Montgomery, the guitarist being a dynamic duo, and The Further Adventures of Jimmy and Wes. So this is kind of the start of that, because there's almost as much Kenny Burrell on this album as there is Jimmy Smith. But in any event, let's listen to this version of Greensleeves by Jimmy Smith. Thank you.
picking up right there with the smoky jazz feel for Christmas. You know, there's something about New York City Christmas, the idea of being in a club on the West Village or the Lower East Side, smoking cigarettes and listening to jazz music that really just gets me all warm and fuzzy. And had to pick a song that felt that way. Booker Irving's White Christmas. This is just a fantastic take on a very, very classic Christmas song. So Booker Irving was a tenor saxophone player, regularly played with Charles Mingus. He learned how to play the saxophone when he was in Okinawa, stationed there with the Air Force, taught himself how to play it, moved to Boston to attend the famed Berklee College of Music, and then moved to New York City to join with Horns Parlance Quartet, and from there began working with Charles Mingus, and at one point formed his own quartet as well. A lot of people at the time were comparing him and his work to that of John Coltrane's. He was gifted the nickname African Cookbook, and really was just throughout the entire 50s and throughout this whole era of kind of jazz highlights in New York City was pretty prominent. Sadly, though, he died of kidney disease at 39 years old. And you hear this song and you're just going to hear a talent that was gone far, far, far too early. Like I was saying, though, this really sounds like a divey underground bar in New York City during Christmas. It sounds like kitschy lights and quiet jazz and whiskey, smoke inside, just smoke like kind of lingering there. It's really the kind of warmth that you crave in the holidays and the city, walking around through cold alleyways and up and down cold streets trying to get some last minute Christmas shopping in or get some last, putting some last shifts at work before you go home to spend a couple days with your family. So just kind of sit back, take a sip of some glug, a little bit of beer, maybe have a shot of whiskey while you're at it. Just get that warm and fuzzy feeling while you're listening to White Christmas here by Booker Irving.
Okay, Brian, thank you for that song. Now, the last song we're going to showcase here is from the late, great Sharon Jones, the Dap Kings, 8 Days of Hanukkah. So this was the opening track from Sharon Jones to the Dap Kings 2016 holiday album. It's a holiday soul party, which was fantastic. And it was also released a mere weeks before she died at the age of 60 from cancer. Very sadly. Actually, I had tickets to see her do a holiday show on December 10th of 2016, and it obviously never happened for that reason. And it's just, she was an incredible singer, incredible musician, full of charisma, and it was a huge loss to anybody who loves funk and soul, and just anyone who, loves seeing an individual who was able to really, really like fulfill a lifelong dream. We know she got the same backing vocals with Fish for Festival 8 in 2009 in Exile on Main Street. And, certainly 2017 felt the loss of not having Sharon Jones around.
Absolutely.
But what's great about this song is that it's an original with lyrics that were obviously written by members of the Dap Kings, backing band, several of whom happen to be Jewish. So there's references to latkes and brisket and playing dreidel, and even how Sharon Jones loves Hanukkah so much more than Pesach. So keep that Manischewitz up on the shelf. The first time I heard this song, I burst out laughing. It's because it was clear that her band members had a ton of fun writing the lyrics and celebrating the holiday. And there's like horn hits corresponding with each of the days. They say like day two, and there's two horn hits. What's always kind of annoyed me about this song is that no one ever thinks of Hanukkah in terms of days. It's always about the nights. It's about eight crazy nights. We light the candles at night. Everything is first night, second night. Yeah, days doesn't make any sense, and the Dap Kings probably knew this, but they figured that singing 8 days of Hanukkah sounds better when it's being sung the nights, so I have to feel that's why they went ahead and did it that way, but take it from this Jewish person that Hanukkah is all about the evening. But in any event, this song is 100 times less annoying than Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song, and really should be a new era Hanukkah standard. So let's listen to 8 Days of Hanukkah from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
For that, David, always great to hear some Sharon Jones, and definitely a loss that we've all felt here in the larger musical community. So recapping the songs that we played, so at the top of the show, you'll remember we talked a bit about two underrated fall holiday run shows. We focus on 12/30/95 as well as 12/29/96 and showcase some highlights from there. We then jumped into our overlooked holiday songs. We started with Willie Nelson's Pretty Paper, moved into Fountains of Wayne, Alien for Christmas, George Lynch's Torrid Christmas Sarajevo 1224 came next. I hope that you guys all enjoyed that. And then in our last segment, we talked about Jimmy Smith's Greensleeves, Booker Irvin's White Christmas, and ended it with Sharon Jones's 8 Days of Hanukkah.
Mm. Just a reminder about you can find us on social media. We're at on Twitter at underscore beyond the pond, one word. We've got a Medium page, medium.com/beyondthepond, and the master Spotify playlist that kind of gathers a bunch of songs we've been playing throughout every episode. We found Beyond the Pond podcast songs. And expanding on Spotify, we actually put together two new playlists that were pretty recent, being the playlist that correspond to all the songs we played in our recent Best of 17 episode. That's Beyond the Pond 27 Best Of. And also all the songs that we had posted when we did our Beyond the Pond Fall 1997 Deep Dive on Twitter. That can be found on hashtag BTP Fall 97 Deep Dive on Spotify. That's got 57 songs and is pretty awesome, if I don't say so myself.
Yeah, good stuff. We're going to keep bringing you guys new diverse playlists, new episodes as we move here into 2018. And I know that we said this in our top albums episode, but this is our last episode of 2017. And we want to thank you guys all who followed along with us in our first year. Some really great community feedback, some great insight from all you guys, and we've really been feeling the love. I am glad to close out 2017 here, and now we are of drinking age as a podcast, which means great things for our future.
In any event, I can say that 2018 is going to be a very monster year for Beyond the Pond. We already have some very interesting guests planned going forward, some interesting episodes. So certainly we are not going to slouch in the new year. So at this point, I would say enjoy the Fish holiday shows. If you happen to go into any of them, if you happen to do a couch tour, I'm very much looking forward to those. I know I have tickets to the 29th and the 30th. My tickets to the 30th are very bad. I might have the Chase Bridge in my face, so I might have to do something about that. But certainly looking forward to that. Brian, you're not going, right? You're in Chicago?
I will unfortunately not be at New Year's this year. I went last year. Going to be in Chicago with family, and then we'll be just arriving back in Maryland to couch tour probably the 30th and the 31st, which I'm excited about. But, yeah, we're going to take a slight break here following this episode being released, but I'm pretty sure we'll be back with a review of whatever goes down at MSG, hoping that they pick up right where they left off after the Baker's Dozen. And then, yeah, like David said, we got some great stuff planned for 2018, not only guests, but also kind of some new and inventive ways to bring you guys new music and talk about Fish and all that sort of stuff. So very, very excited here.
So on that note, I would say happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Merry Fish Holiday Run. And we will definitely be back in 2018. And until then, smoke them if you got them, and then come back in January. We'll be together. We'll go beyond the pond.